Okay. Hare Krishna. Does everybody speak English?
No.
How did you know what I just said then? Next couple of days, of course, this is August the 25th, yeah? And tomorrow is Janmashtami. The day afterwards is Vyasa Puja of Srila Prabhupada. So I'll be here for those 2 days. And then after that, I think I go to Split for a few, I don't know how long, a couple of days or something. And then I think I come back here again for a couple of days. So what I've been doing is I have this seminar called Srila Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam. And this is using material that I gathered up when I was traveling with Srila Prabhupada from November 1975 up until March 1977. So it's about a 16-month period. During that period, I was keeping a diary as I was serving Srila Prabhupada and recording all the events that happened. And also I was recording conversations, morning walks, etc., on the tape recorder. So with those two sources, a handwritten diary and the recorded material, and also later on I was able to retrieve from the Bhaktivedanta archives in North Carolina all the correspondence that Srila Prabhupada engaged in during that period. So I have all the letters that were written to him, as well as Srila Prabhupada's replies. So with those three sources, later on I was able to combine them together into a book form called Transcendental Diary. So far we've come out with about 5 volumes of that. The latest volume just came out at the beginning of this year. And except for the first one, that one covers 4 months. The other 4 volumes, each one covers a 2-month period from that period that I was traveling with Srila Prabhupada. So what I did was I took different topics or items of devotional service, chanting, prasadam, cleanliness, health, living in the Dham, book writing, book distribution, etc., and pulled out all the different material that was relevant to each topic and kind of put them in some kind of an order. So this seminar is a presentation of different topics of devotional service, but as practiced by Srila Prabhupada, or comments that Srila Prabhupada made on those particular topics. So it's really, as I say, it's the Living Bhagavatam. Srila Prabhupada, of course, well, we say that verse in the morning, that there are the 2 Bhagavatams. There's the book Bhagavat, and there's the person Bhagavat. And Srila Prabhupada was very much the emblem of devotional service. We learnt as much from Srila Prabhupada by his practical example as we did from his books. Of course, the books Prabhupada always emphasized are more important, because the vani, or the teachings, survive after the disappearance of the person that has delivered those teachings. But still, without the actual practical example, it would be very difficult to assimilate what is in the books. And therefore, the personal presence of the guru is very much an essential factor in learning and progressing in devotional life. So, as I mentioned, I became Prabhupada's personal servant in late 1975. Prabhupada had come to New Delhi. At that time, the New Delhi temple was situated in a place called Bengali Markets. If you've ever been to New Delhi, there's a central area called Connaught Place, or Connaught Circus. And then just off from there, there's this place, small area, called Bengali Markets. There's a Bengali sweet shop and restaurant and other things. And there was a small road, a dead-end road called Todemal Lane, and we had a very small building there, which was serving as the New Delhi Temple at that time. It was kind of a temporary place. And Prabhupada had come there on November 25th, and he was waiting there for a couple of days until he could go to Kurukshetra. In Kurukshetra, of course, that's the Kurukshetra that we read about in the Bhagavad Gita from 5,000 years ago. It's still there, three hours north of Delhi. And there are still millions of pilgrims that go there, as they were at the time of Lord Krishna, and even way before then. So Prabhupada had a plan to build a Vedic university there. And Ambarish Prabhu, he had given Srila Prabhupada $150,000 to begin that project. So when Prabhupada came to Delhi, he came there with one servant, that was Harikesh, and then he was joined by Hansa Dutta, who came in from Germany to be Prabhupada's secretary. But there was actually no servant there to do Prabhupada's massage. So somehow or another, by what I can only describe as inconceivable good fortune, I happened to be in Delhi on the day that Prabhupada arrived, and somehow or another Prabhupada asked me to massage him indirectly through his other servants. So I started off massaging Prabhupada. Then a few days after that, then I was added to Prabhupada's party as his regular servant. So after Delhi and then one day in Kurukshetra, then Prabhupada traveled on December the 2nd to Vrindavan, and he was to spend 10 days there in Vrindavan. So that day, December the 2nd, was when I was actually officially made the full-time servant. So I got a chance to be with Srila Prabhupada in his quarters and to observe him very closely for the first time, you know, for like a full 24-hour period. So the nice thing about being Prabhupada's servant was that you got to see him in informal settings. Normally, you know, we would only see Prabhupada sitting on the Vyasasan, or if you were lucky, you might get out on a morning walk with him, or if you were in India with him, then you might get into Prabhupada's room in the afternoons for an hour's darshan. But it was still quite formal setting. But when you were on his party, of course, then you saw him in much more informal settings, just relaxing when everybody else had gone out. Sometimes he would chit-chat with you. You know, he'd take his meals, he'd take rest, etc. So it was another dimension of Srila Prabhupada that most devotees didn't get to see. So this first day then that I'd been added to Prabhupada's party, I had a very striking realization about Srila Prabhupada. And I've given the title of this seminar based on that realization that I had on that first day. So this was on December the 2nd, 1975, in Vrindavan. It is extremely pleasurable to be with Srila Prabhupada during the quiet moments. He is gentle and mild in his manner and completely fixed and steady in his devotion to Krishna. He has tremendous strength and force, but is devoid of passion. His presence is totally dominating without being at all domineering. His mind is steady and his senses are controlled effortlessly. His intelligence is perfectly clear, and he knows how to act and how others should act in every situation. His presence thus makes spiritual life a reality. Watching him today, it struck me that he is a living, breathing Bhagavatam. Whatever description of Krishna consciousness is in his books, he himself is that. Reading his books brings gradual realization, but what is understood in perhaps several lifetimes of study is revealed on a second-to-second, minute-to-minute, and day-to-day basis in Srila Prabhupada's personal association. I have therefore resolved within myself to learn as much as I can while I have this matchless opportunity to observe him closely. Simply watching Srila Prabhupada in his daily activities, how he deals with the devotees, how he responds to different situations, how he preaches, how he manages the worldwide affairs of his ever-expanding society, how he relaxes, how he continually pushes forward the movement of Lord Chaitanya, and how absolutely every facet of his being is fully Krishna conscious. It is quite feasible to understand the full import of the sacred scriptures. By studying and preaching, one may make steady advancement. But at least for me, although I have full faith in Krishna consciousness, many ideas and principles are still only intellectually perceived, but not yet fully realized. But by observing Srila Prabhupada, I can see that they are a natural, integral part of his very being. So that was a very clear and strong realization. I just saw Srila Prabhupada and I understood everything that's in all of the books, it's right there in Srila Prabhupada's character, and all I have to do is just observe him. That's all. And I'll learn everything that there is to know, or that I need to know at least, about Krishna consciousness. And actually that proved to be true, although I can't say that I've assimilated it all yet, but it's there. And it was all there in Srila Prabhupada. There was another occasion when this question of the living Bhagavatam was raised, this time by Srila Prabhupada himself. And this was later in 1976. Prabhupada was in New Mayapur in France. We had been on what proved to be the last world tour, and New Mayapur was the second to last stop before we returned to India. So whilst we were there, Srila Prabhupada had a visitor, he was a professor, called François Chenik. Professor Chenik had written a very favorable review of Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, the French edition. And he was very friendly to the devotees, and he was an influential person in the French university system. So he came to visit with Srila Prabhupada on August the 5th, and they had some discussions. He was a very nice man. Actually, when he came, he was wearing a dhoti, and he had beads around his neck, and he had tilak. Although he said that he wasn't actually a bhakta, he was more of an impersonalist. He said he was, you know, inclined to Buddhism, and then actually from visiting Prabhupada, he was on his way towards a Buddhist retreat. But still, he appreciated, and Prabhupada encouraged him. When he said that, no, I'm not a bhakta, Prabhupada said, yes, then that means you are one, because you're very humble. And that is because you're saying I'm not a bhakta, then therefore you are one, because you're being humble. So anyway, the preliminary introduction's done. Professor Chenik said that he was keen to see Srila Prabhupada's Srimad Bhagavatam come into use. There is only one other French edition of it, done in the 1800s, and that has no commentary. Yet, at the university level, he said, the French are meticulous about maintaining the grammatical standards of their language. He was politely concerned that our translations should not smell of English, as he put it. Because the French have a paranoia about English invading their language. So he said the translation should not smell of English. He felt that since our books are translated from English, the French literary expression is not always exactly correct. Describing French as a more compact language than English, he wondered whether it might not be better to translate directly from the Sanskrit into the French. So actually it's interesting about Srila Prabhupada's translation work, because all of the other languages that were done were all taken from the English, including Bengali and Hindi. Prabhupada was born and brought up in Bengal, but the Bengali books that we have of Prabhupada's are all translated from the English. Prabhupada wasn't writing in Bengali, he was writing in English, because that was the instruction that had been given to him by his spiritual master. So even before he came to the West, Prabhupada was writing in English. although I did do some small works in Bengali and Hindi. But the main work, Bhagavatam, that was all in English, even before coming to the West. Anyway, so Prabhupada was not very concerned. While acknowledging that if possible, improvements could be made to future editions, he explained that as yet, no French devotee had become a Sanskritist. But besides that, it is not a question of scholarship. The translator must be a realized soul. He said that although there are many Sanskrit scholars in India, they cannot understand the Srimad Bhagavatam. He must be French, expert in language, at the same time a devotee, Prabhupada told him. Then he can explain. Otherwise, no. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's secretary, Swarup Damodar, he asked that Bhagavat Panagiya Bhagavatastane, go and study the Bhagavat from the Bhagavat. So I have discussed this in the beginning of the translation of the Bhagavat. So that Bhagavat is the limit of education. Vidya Bhagavata Vadi. One has to study and take education up to the Bhagavatam. That is, if one understands the Bhagavatam, then he has finished his education. The professor assured Prabhupada that he wasn't in any way criticizing, but he was concerned that Prabhupada got the widest possible audience. He felt that an improvement in the way the French editions were written would ensure that. Srila Prabhupada appreciated his concern, but he continued to stress his point. That is from the scholarship point of view, but our point is this Bhagavatam must be presented by the Bhagavat, and there is not much scholarship required. Just like Bhagavat begins with the words Jamadhyasya Yata. So this Sanskrit word means the absolute truth is that from where everything emanates. Now, that absolute truth further explained, Anvayat itaratas cha abhigyasvarat. The absolute truth is aware of everything, directly and indirectly, of all this creation. So in this way, if you step-by-step study, it is not very difficult so far the word meanings are concerned. But it is a question of realization. Unless one is realized, he cannot explain properly. That is the secret. Therefore, we have given the life of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in our Bhagavatam because he is the living Bhagavatam. So there, that was Prabhupada's appreciation of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And of course, Srila Prabhupada was the best representative of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. If anybody represented Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in a wonderful way, then Srila Prabhupada did by spreading his movement and fulfilling the prediction, Prativi Chaya Chajato Nagarati Gram, that the name of the Lord would be spread all over the world. So Srila Prabhupada was the one who fulfilled that. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada is also the living Bhagavatam. So that's a little introduction. Now I have different topics, as I say. Let me see. But I thought that it might be appropriate over the next couple of days, since we're coming up to Prabhupada's Vyasa Puja, that we could get a deeper appreciation of Srila Prabhupada's books, since we're talking about the Bhagavat and the living Bhagavat. Then, of course, Prabhupada, you know, he considered it his main contribution was the writing of his books. And we used to have this slogan, books are the basis. So I thought it'd be nice if we read or hear about Srila Prabhupada's writing, at least for the next couple of days. When I come back, if we finish this section, then we can go on to something else. In Ljubljana, we just had 3 or 4 sessions about chanting. So we kind of finished that one. If you want to get that seminar, it is available on MP3. I can give you copies of that. But tonight we'll begin with Prabhupada's writing. So Srila Prabhupada, of course, didn't just suddenly start writing. He had a history of being a good writer. And during the course of being with Prabhupada, I heard little, you know, fragments of Prabhupada's history. Sometimes he would sit down and he would suddenly tell us about something from his previous life before coming to the West and starting ISKCON. And in Prabhupada's dealings with other devotees as well sometimes, then he would reveal little incidents from his previous activities. So as far as Prabhupada's writing goes then, there's, according to Prabhupada himself, his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, very much appreciated Srila Prabhupada's ability to write. So on December the 5th, 1975, we were in Sri Vrindavan Dham, and Prabhupada received a letter from Rameshwara Das, who was the head of the American division of the Book Trust. He reported a recent new record in book distribution. In a one-day competition, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Atlanta temples distributed 5,406 hardbound books. One day, I think that was on the American Thanksgiving Day holiday. So some individual devotees sold over 200 books each. Rameshwara's report was dramatic. Our men are willing to do anything to please you, and all of them have dedicated their whole lives to distributing these books. Our only desire is that you may kindly bless us with greater and greater desire to distribute these books all over the world until every home has whole libraries of your books. By your divine grace's blessing, we will never stop distributing these books. We are thinking that this is the highest pleasure in all the three worlds. Srila Prabhupada's response was equally enthusiastic. Your report of book sales is over-encouraging. You are all becoming very, very dear to my Guru Maharaj. I started this movement by book selling. I was never a beggar for money, but I was writing books and selling. My Guru Maharaj very much liked my writing, and he used to show others in my absence, just see how nicely he has written, how he has appreciated. He encouraged me, and my godbrothers, they also liked my writing. After I wrote that poem for Vyasa Puja of my Guru Maharaj, they used to call me poet. That's that famous offering of Prabhupada's, adore, adore ye all the happy day, blessed than heaven, sweeter than May. So, Srila Prabhupada's Guru Maharaj, when he read that, he used to show it to other devotees and say, just see how he's nicely is written. And that was also in English, that poem that he wrote. That was in 1935. Anyway, I was working, writing books and publishing BTG alone, but I could not give the thing shape, and so I decided to go to the USA. And now you all nice boys and girls have helped me so much. It is the mercy of Krishna. Thank you very much. So that was Prabhupada relating how his Guru Maharaj liked his writing. So that was back in the 30s. Again, July 26, 1976, we were in London, and we were having a little discussion. Bhagavan Das, who was the GBC of France at that time, Southern Europe, and one sannyasi, French sannyasi, Prataputra Swami, they flew in from France, and they presented Srila Prabhupada some samples of the new French Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, first part. So Prabhupada turned his attention to the books laying on his desk. He said, my Guru Maharaj is very pleased. As soon as a book comes out, he is pleased. He was lamenting that these men, they did not publish any number of books. They are simply after this stone and bricks. He's talking about his godbrothers, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's disciples. Bhaktisiddhanta was complaining, these men are not interested actually in books. They're only interested in who gets which room and, you know, who has control of which temple. So he was lamenting like that. He condemned. He was very, very sorry. So I thought, I must take a risk. And he is pleased. So now you have books and temples, Bhagavan said. Prabhupada smiled. Yes, temple is automatically. I never stressed on temple. I was engaged in publishing Back to Godhead. Whatever I could do, I did it because I took it very seriously that he is very sorry that these things were not done. He said that there will be fire in this Gaudiya Math. Agun Jvalbe, he said. Amari Tachi Loka Kichu Boy Kakrai Boy. If I can, I shall sell the marbles of this temple and convert them into books. So that was his ambition. He started a very nice press, and this Tirtha Maharaj sold it. Tirtha Maharaj was one of the godbrothers that entered into litigation immediately after Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's disappearance. Then there was a big fight that took place, and the whole unity of the Gaudiya Math was broken. This Tirtha Maharaj eventually, by going to court, he had himself declared as the next Acharya by legal means. And press that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had, he sold that press so that he could pay for the court case. So in that way, Prabhupada was very disgusted with him. Sold it, Jaitirtha asked in surprise. Yes, Prabhupada said. He is not representing Guru. Oh, better let us have money for fighting in the court. Sometimes I'm sorry that my name also has this word in it, Jaitirtha said a little ruefully. Jaitirtha was the GBC at that time in England. Prabhupada paused a moment and then offered him a word of comfort and encouragement. You are Jayatirtha. You are victorious. Now, whatever is being done, it is by Bhaktisiddhanta's blessings. So let us work sincerely. These things will all be done, otherwise it is humanly impossible. It is only by his grace. So George Harrison had visited that same day, and in the afternoon Prabhupada had entertained him, and Prabhupada had asked him if he was reading the books. So George had commented that, well, I've been given them, but actually, you know, there's so much to read. He said, I can't understand how you could have written so much stuff, because there's more than an ordinary man can even read. So Jaitirtha mentioned that George was also commenting on that, how one man could have written so many books. He could not even read them all, what to speak of writing them. So Prabhupada quoted a Sanskrit verse, Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate garim yak kripa tamaham vande shri gurun dinatarinam. A dumb person becomes a great orator. The lame man is jumping over the mountain. Yak kripa, by the mercy of the Guru, it is possible. So let us cooperate and do this business. The higher authority will be pleased, and that is our success. Yasya prasadad bhagavat prasada. If the higher authorities are pleased, then Krishna is pleased, and that is our success. So there'll be a little bit more about this principle of the higher authorities in a minute. So Prabhupada, as I say, was always a good writer, and even at school he was recognized for his writing. So on January 12, 1976, we were in Calcutta, and of course Prabhupada had gone to school in Calcutta there. He'd gone to Scottish Church's College in his high school, etc. So Jaipataka Maharaj was there, and he reported to Srila Prabhupada that a small Bengali book that Prabhupada had written before going to the West in 1965, called Gita Gan, is now in print and selling many copies. It contains all the Bhagavad Gita verses in Bengali rhyme, and it was written in such a way that no one could misinterpret the meaning. So Prabhupada had gone through all the verses of the Bhagavad Gita, 700, and put them into rhyming Bengali. But he'd done it in such a clever way that you couldn't derive any other meaning than that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because he knew very well, in India, practically 100%, everybody is a Mayavadi. They all think that God is, you know, impersonal. So Prabhupada wrote this Gita Gan in such a way that people would learn the verses, because it was a rhyme, and at the same time get the proper meaning from it. So Prabhupada was very pleased to hear that all the Mayapur Gurukul children are studying it and learning to chant the verses. smilingly, he recalled how his godbrothers used to call him Cavi, or poet, and that even at school, he would write English verse. So later in the year, we were in Hyderabad. Prabhupada had gone there in August to open the new Hyderabad temple on Janmashtami and Vyasa Puja. So Jayapataka Maharaj and Gagamuni Maharaj had come to see Srila Prabhupada from Mayapur, and they'd given a report on the activities there. So on August the 21st, Prabhupada was talking with them. Prabhupada was especially pleased with the news of the sales of his Bengali language book, Gita Gan. The sannyasis said that everywhere they went, people were asking for it, and some devotees were selling up to 200 at a time. It was becoming so popular that when Jayapataka went to the Writers' Building in Calcutta, Writers' Building is the state government secretariat. It's where all the public servants and the chief minister, they all have their offices there. So he had gone there on business about the land acquisition for Mayapur, and the workers there were approaching him to buy copies of Gita Gan. Jayapataka said the only difficulty was that we lacked Prabhupada's books in the local languages. To rectify this, he has set up a team to begin translating the English books. The translators are Subhag Das, now Subhag Maharaj, Tatpur Das, and a new devotee, Kishore, who was a freelance writer and former honors student from Calcutta University. Kishore later on became Bhakti Charuswami. Jayapataka personally reads through what they have done to make sure that there are no philosophical errors. Gagamuni said that it was difficult to get Hindi or other Indian language translations done, and Prabhupada agreed. Impersonal idea is in everybody's head. God has no legs, he has no head. Simply he, the translator, has a head. Prabhupada said that even the Aryan translation of the topmost yoga system done by Gaur Govinda Maharaj, which Gagamuni had brought with him, should wait for publication until someone could check that it was up to standard. Prabhupada told Jayapataka to locate another work that he had done in the late 1940s in Bengali called Bhagavana Katha. He had written it as a series of articles for the Gaudiya newspaper, which had been produced by the Devananda Gaudiya Mat. Unpretentiously, he said, they were so popular that the report was that the readers of the Gaudiya were only hankering after that Bhagavana Katha. After reading it, they would throw away the paper. Other articles, they were not interested. So always your writing, people were attracted by it, Jayapataka Swami said appreciatively. Yes, that is a fact, Prabhupada said modestly. Even my teachers were attracted in my school days. In my matriculation class, I wrote some essay and I got out of 100, 85 marks. But the teacher came into the class. He asked, "Who has written this?" So I stood up and he thanked me. "Yes, it is very nice." He especially came to thank me for that essay. So Prabhupada, right from his school days, he was very expert at writing. He could write prose, essays, and he could write poems as well. And that was a repeated feature of his devotional service, you know, after he met Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. And of course we know that in 1944, that was when he set up BTG. He was doing that all alone, writing his own newspaper. So he was always expert in writing in English. And of course the other thing that Prabhupada needed to be able to do his work on the Bhagavatam was Sanskrit. He was expert in English, but he was also expert in Sanskrit. On June the 17th, 1976, we were in Toronto, and we were having a conversation there, which ranged over a number of interesting topics, with Srila Prabhupada sharing his unique insights into social life, history, education, and culture. He inquired about the progress of our Gurukul, since this is now Jagadish Das's only portfolio. And he expressed his doubts about the standard of teaching. He informed Jagadish that in Los Angeles, Pradyumna had complained that his six-year-old son, Aniruddha, who was in the Gurukul there, could not write from 1 to 10. Pradyumna also claimed that the Sanskrit level was poor. Prabhupada said he had personally observed in Dallas that the students could not chant the Sanskrit nicely, although it was simply a question of practice. You see, to these two things especially, English is their mother tongue, so they can become English scholar very easily. And Sanskrit language is no difficulty. Read and write, then he will learn. Our education in Sanskrit was in college. Of course, I was the best student in my class at Sanskrit. I was standing first. But we are not like the so-called Sanskrit scholars. But for our purpose, we can read and write, and that's all. Similarly, we don't want any very learned scholars, Sanskrit grammarian, to manufacture a jugglery of words and meanings. No, we don't want that. So that was there. Prabhupada mentioned that he was top of his class when he was at school in Sanskrit. So that was the two main things, Sanskrit and English. Prabhupada was very expert at both of those. So then, as I mentioned, Back to Godhead came later on, in 1944, that was first published. So there was a discussion with a newspaper reporter in New York on July 14th, 1976. This man was from Newsday magazine, which was a very big magazine in those days. I don't know whether it's still going now. But the reporter, Kevin Lehart, he was a very nice man, very sharp, did a very good interview. Prabhupada liked him. So he asked Srila Prabhupada, "You came here 10 years or 11 years ago. You were almost 70 at the time. What had you been doing previously?" "Previously," Prabhupada said, "I was a family man. I retired in 1954. My Guru Maharaj asked me to take this seriously when I was 25 years old. So I was at that time a family man, and so I thought, let me adjust my family affairs, then I shall take it up. So by doing the adjustment, it took me long years, and I retired at the age of 58. So Prabhupada was saying he was making the adjustment so that he could fulfill his spiritual master's instructions from the age of 25 up to the age of 58. He was adjusting his family life so that he could get free to do his preaching. "Then I took up seriously, and when I was 70 years old, then I came here." "Were you a businessman?" he asked. "Yes, I was connected with some chemical industry. I was a manager in a big chemical industry. Then I started my own business. In this way, I was a family man." Rameshwar and Bali Mardan explained that throughout Prabhupada's life, he was Krishna conscious, and even as a householder, he was writing. And Prabhupada said, "Yes, this Back to Godhead was started in 1944 when I was still a family man." So that was going on, that Back to Godhead writing. In 44, Prabhupada, I think, was able to come out with only one issue, either one or two issues, and then it had to stop. He couldn't get the paper, and of course he was wrapped up with, you know, family affairs, etc., so it was difficult. But then in the 1950s, when he actually gradually gave up his family involvement, he took up more and more writing. And we see that during the period from the mid-50s to the late-50s, Srila Prabhupada actually did produce several more editions of the Back to Godhead magazine. It wasn't exactly a magazine, it was in a newspaper format. And he was doing everything himself. He was the writer, he was the editor, he did the layout, he personally oversaw the printing of it, and he was the distributor also. Everything. Only one man operation. And he had no money either when he was doing it. He would somehow or another talk the printer into printing the next edition, even though he couldn't pay for it. And he would promise him, "No, when I sell this, then I'll pay you." And then he would go around and try and sell his Back to Godhead. So we were having a little discussion on January 20th, 1976 in Mayapur. And in the evening, His Divine Grace told us more about his life before establishing ISKCON. He explained that when he began publishing Back to Godhead, many people appreciated it, including his godbrother Bon Maharaj and others. So one librarian friend asked him, "Why not write books? A paper is thrown away, but a book is kept." So in 1958, he wrote Easy Journey to Other Planets. Then in 1960, he began the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, publishing the first part in 1962. In 1963 came part two, and by the end of 1964, part three. Each printing was 1,100 copies, the cost donated by a wealthy business magnate. So that was the period then when, from 1959, Srila Prabhupada was invited to go and live in the Radha Damodar temple. Prior to that, for two or three years, he'd been living in a temple called the Bamsi Gopal Temple, which is immediately behind Kesigat Palace. There's an old palace there. And just tucked in behind that, there's this Bamsi Gopal Temple. And Prabhupada had a room on the roof, which he could see out over the whole of Vrindavan and over the Jamuna. So he was living there, but he knew the Mahant, or the Saivites, at the Radha Damodar Mandir, and they invited him to come and live there. And during that period when he was living in Radha Damodar Mandir, that was when he took up very seriously this book writing. And that was when he began his work on the Srimad Bhagavatam. So we mentioned previously that Prabhupada said that everything is done by the superior authority. So Prabhupada wasn't talking figuratively, as you'll see. So on July the 26th, 1976, this again when we were, Prabhupada had just received this new French Bhagavatam. So everybody else went out, Prabhupada's room. I remained for a few minutes more, alone with Srila Prabhupada. During the conversation, I had flipped through the pages of the new French Bhagavatam and had noticed a picture of Srila Prabhupada's kitchen in the Radha Damodar temple in Vrindavan. In those days, we didn't, you know, have many photographs of these things. And this was the very first time that it had been included in one of Prabhupada's books. So it was very kind of interesting. And so I told Srila Prabhupada that this picture's there. So Prabhupada, he said, "Oh, where is it?" He was kind of enthusiastic to see it. So I found the page for him. Opportunities like this don't arise frequently. So as he inspected the brownish photo, I asked a few questions about Prabhupada's life before ISKCON. Through that window, you could see Rupa Goswami's Samadhi. And for those two rooms, they were charging you 5 rupees a month? "Yes," Prabhupada said. "Those rooms were broken, so they told me that you can repair these, and whatever you like, you can give." So I thought, I don't need much space. Before me, there was a tenant in that other room, and he was paying 3 rupees. So I thought, 2 rooms, but I have spent some money, so I'll give him 5. Now I'm giving him 10 rupees. "To retain it," I said. "Yes," Prabhupada said. "Sometimes the devotees go there to clean the rooms out," I told him, "and they have kirtan there as well. I think this is the first book that somebody's included this photo." "Yes," Prabhupada said. "It was very calm and quiet, and people used to offer obeisances from outside because they knew. Practically everyone knew me, and so they used to offer." "Oh, you were very well known in Vrindavan before you came?" "Not very well known, but people knew me." Because you were writing?" I asked. "Yes." "Or because of your ambition to come to the West?" "No, at that time there was no such thing," Prabhupada replied. "I was living there, retired man." "So when you went to Vrindavan, you'd given up the idea of coming to the West?" "No, coming to the West, the idea was there, but I was planning how to go there, how to preach there, how to take some books, how to bring them. So everything alone." "So as soon as you had some books, then you were ready?" "Yes, then I decided." So everything was being dictated by superior. With Srila Prabhupada in such a congenial mood, I took the courage to broach something that Hari Kesh had once mentioned to me. "I was told that one day you were told by Rupa Goswami that you must go." Prabhupada's mood changed slightly. "But that was open secret," he said dismissively. "Everyone knew." And then he changed the subject. So Hari Kesh had told me that on some occasion Srila Rupa Goswami had appeared to Srila Prabhupada and had given him instructions about preaching in the West. But we had no, he had no further information of that. And it was always in my mind that if I ever get the chance, I'm going to ask Srila Prabhupada about this. But of course you can't just, you know, walk in and say, Prabhupada, can you tell me about, you know, the time that it's, you know, you have to wait the opportunity. And if Prabhupada, you know, is in the mood when he's giving out this kind of information, then you can ask. But you, you know, it's very intimate, obviously. And you can't just expect that he'll speak. So that was the opportunity. He was speaking about the Radha Damodar temple. And I and when he said that everything was being dictated by superior, I thought, this is the opportunity. And although Prabhupada didn't give me any information on it, he did confirm it. As he said, that was an open secret. Everybody knew. But we didn't know. And that was 1976. It wasn't until last year, 2004, that I heard anything more about this particular incident. And this there's a new book that's just come out. It was a compilation of interviews that had been put together by one of my god sisters, Mulla Prakriti Dasi, who left her body last year in Vrindavan. So she had been interviewing people that knew Srila Prabhupada before he came to the West. So in that book, there's an interview with Gopal Chandra Ghosh, who's about 61 or 62 now. He works in the Vrindavan Research Institute, which is just down the road from Krishna Balaram Mandir, not very far, next block. So he knew Srila Prabhupada when he was a young man. And he used to go and see him when Prabhupada was in residence at the Radha Damodar Mandir. So he recalls, there were several times I recall him telling me about his Gurudev. Once he had a fever and was sitting covered with a cloth and a blanket reading the Srimad Bhagavatam. I bowed my head to his feet and asked, "You are not feeling well?" He said, "No, I have this cold, so this little medicinal cure will be helpful." The next day, when I returned, he was happy, healthy, and was writing, maybe a commentary I did not see. So I asked, "Today you were feeling better?" He answered very mysteriously, "Oh yes." I asked him again, and he said, "At night, my Prabhupada came to me in my dream. He encouraged me, saying, 'You do work like Narottam Thakur, like Srinivas Acharya, and like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur.' Swami Maharaj told me joyfully, 'I have received mercy from my Gurudev. He has blessed me and has given me power. I was too much anxious for the Bhagavat commentary.' He said, 'You just write and all the six Goswamis will help you.' He also mentioned then that his Gurudev had come in front of him in sannyas dress two or three times when he had been sickly. During these months, when I would visit him in his rooms at Radha Damodar, he occasionally told me some special things that I understood as secrets in his bhajan. Once I came early in the winter, early in the morning in the winter time. He was chanting Harinam very deeply, and I saw tears coming from his eyes. When I inquired several times from him to tell me anything, he said that he had received a visit last night. In the courtyard by Srila Rupa Goswami's Samadhi, he saw some very beautiful persons. One was wearing only kopin and was chanting on large tulsi mala around his neck. His eyes were like large lotus flowers, and he was extremely effulgent. Also coming there was another personality, dressed similarly, but older and taller, very kindly to him. And behind them was a much younger sadhu, whose beauty and sweetness were captivating. Swami Maharaj told me that they were Srila Rupa Goswami, Srila Sanatan Goswami, and their nephew Srila Jiva Goswami. He said they spoke to him and gave him mercy and guidance for his writing and his future preaching. I tried to ask more, but this is all that he would tell me." So when Prabhupada said that this is by the mercy of his Guru Maharaj and by the superior authority, he was not talking figuratively. He was literally told and instructed how to write the Bhagavatam, And that's why Prabhupada had the potency that he had, because it was coming directly from that superior authority. So later on in 1976, actually before I go on, I will mention about this particular book. It's called Srila Prabhupada, A Friend to Everyone, something like that. Let me just get that. I better get it right. Our Srila Prabhupada, A Friend to All. It's a very nice book. It's got, you know, lots of remembrances like this. But I will say that you have to be very cautious when you read books of that nature. When you're interviewing people that are trying to recall events from 50, 60 years ago, then you can't expect to get completely accurate details. And the other thing is, of course, that sometimes people tend to be a little motivated, you know, when they're speaking about a famous person that they happen to know before he became famous. You know, they tend to kind of get a little, you know, reflected glory by the fact that they knew him. And so sometimes they embellish their stories to make it, you know, appear more favorable. Oh, that I knew your Guru Maharaj before you knew him, like this. So you have to be a little careful about this. And a classic example of this is in the Prabhupada Lilamrita, where the descriptions there of Srila Prabhupada leaving Calcutta docks on the Jaladutta to sail to the west. So in that description, it's given by some man, I think his name's like Shushir Kumar Ghosh or Shushil Kumar or something like that. I forget his name now. But anyway, they have him quoted there saying that, yes, I went with him in the taxi to the docks. Nobody was there to greet him. There was nobody there to say goodbye. He was all alone, you know, and he went up the gangplank and on the ship, you know, and then he sailed away. So it's a very kind of romantic, you know, description, you know, the lone warrior going off. Nobody knew who he was. Nobody was there to see him, you know, see him off, and away he went. And then he became this, you know, big superstar. It's all bogus. It never happened. What actually happened was revealed in Prabhupada's own diary. Now that diary, Prabhupada kept a diary when, before and during the period and after the immediate period of his landing in America. So when he was on the Jaladutta. He later on gave that diary to a devotee, Bali Mardan, to keep for safekeeping. Bali Mardan left the movement after about 1977 and kind of disappeared for a while. So nobody knew about this diary. We didn't know it existed until about 1990 when Bali Mardan suddenly contacted the archives and said, you know, I've got Prabhupada's original diary. So he sent it to them and they published that. So it's called the Jaladutta Diary. So I got a copy of that. The first thing that I wanted to know was I wanted to see what Prabhupada had written, you know, about his leaving Calcutta that particular day, because he told me that, you know, the day before he had gone to Mayapur to the Chaitanya Mat there where his Guru Maharaj's Samadhi is, and he had gone there to get the blessings of his Guru Maharaj before leaving, and then he returned to Calcutta and the next day he sailed away. So I went to that portion and you know, I kind of, like everybody else, I liked that description, you know, that romantic description of Prabhupada sailing away there all on his own. But then I read his diary, and Prabhupada says very clearly that when he went to the docks, there were four or five people there to greet him. The ship's captain was there. There was a representative from Sindhya's steamship company. His son, Brindaban Day, went with him. So, you know, it's completely bogus what this man had said. Because why did he say it? Because only he was there, right? This Ghosh, that, oh, I saw your Guru Maharaj sail off, but nobody else saw it, only me, like this. So you have to be really, really careful when you read these kinds of books. The sentiment's nice, but you cannot necessarily verify the fact. But in this case, I've included this description from this gentleman from the Brindaban Research Institute, because Prabhupada confirmed it to me personally that Rupa Goswami had appeared to him when he was staying at the Radhadamada, and this was a more complete description. So therefore I've included it, but I'm just letting you know, be careful if you read these kinds of books. Anyway, so again, on this topic of Prabhupada saying that it was all done by the superior direction, then September 4th, 1976, we were in Vrindavan, and Prabhupada had given a class, and then we were sitting in his room discussing. So later in the morning, Harikesh Swami and I sat with Srila Prabhupada in his darshan room. He was discussing the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 25, Verse 21. Harikesh read it out. Titiksheva Karunika Suridasava Dayanam Ajata Shatrava Shanta Sadhava Sadhu Bhushanaha. The symptoms of a sadhu is that he is tolerant, merciful, and friendly to all living entities. He has no enemies, he is peaceful, he abides by the scriptures, and all of his characteristics are sublime. Srila Prabhupada smiled in satisfaction. This is sadhu, not the dress. Then he had Harikesh read out his lengthy purport. Let's see. So Prabhupada said, the description of the sadhu is there. It is very nice. Where will they find this description all over the world? Complimenting Prabhupada, Harikesh said, I think there's only one person who's following that description. But Prabhupada had a different mood. He humbly appreciated the words of the Shastra. No, I say about the Bhagavat's description, how perfect it is in every subject matter. And he provided a revealing insight into the source of his own words in the purport. I have tried to explain what is there in the Bhagavatam, expand it. That is not my explanation, that is Krishna's explanation. I cannot explain that now. At that moment, I could explain. That means Krishna's. I can understand that. That the description is very nicely given. Although it is my writing, I know that it is not my writing. It is Krishna's writing. So we should read the Bhagavatam always. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. We should not waste our time. This is not the first time that Prabhupada has said that when he writes, he is simply acting as a mouthpiece for Krishna. His words and humility today merely emphasized his role as the transparent via media between us and Krishna, and it gave us another glimpse into the intimacy of his relationship with the Lord. So, again, another confirmation there that Prabhupada said, it's not my writing. When I sat down, I could write it then, at that moment. But now I couldn't do it. That means it was Krishna giving me the words. So, this is this standard. As Prabhupada said, that it presentation of the Bhagavat has to be by the Bhagavat, by the person, the living Bhagavat. And unless you have that kind of advancement in devotional life, then what you will write, who knows whether it will be effective or not. But Prabhupada's writing is potent, because it was coming directly from Krishna. So more appreciations of Prabhupada's writing. Again, this meeting with George Harrison in 1976, in July 26, at the manor there in England. Prabhupada asked George if he was reading his books at all. George said that he was, mainly the Krishna book. Mukundi gave me the new books, but there's so much in them, there's just so much to read. I don't know how anybody could have written it. It's difficult enough to read all that amount. Prabhupada acknowledged his appreciation. Sometimes they are surprised how one man can write so many books, but it is Krishna's grace, he said humbly. Otherwise, not possible. For a human being, it is not possible. So, Prabhupada was always busy with his writing. That was his main occupation. And we see, we had a discussion with Prabhupada in Melbourne, in Australia, in April of 1976, on the 22nd. We were just chit-chatting. Pushta Krishna Swami was Prabhupada's secretary at that time, and we were waiting for some guests to arrive. So such informal conversations are always extremely sweet, and they give us the opportunity to ask specific questions and also to sometimes find out more details about Prabhupada's past activities. Pushta Krishna Maharaj asked if many people had come to hear from him before his coming to the West. People were coming, Prabhupada said, but he had no time to visit many places or people because he was very busy with his writing. To me, it seemed very significant that Prabhupada had reversed the usual trend. Usually, somebody retires and dedicates their remaining days to writing, but Prabhupada wrote and then came out to teach his writings by practical example. Pushta Krishna added that he didn't think that Krishna consciousness would have had much effect upon people without Srila Prabhupada's personal example. Srila Prabhupada modestly agreed. That was the example, as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he said, to teach by personal example. So that was a little indication. Prabhupada said that he was busy with his writing and therefore he didn't have much opportunity to go out, although he did go here and there a little bit. But we got a little bit more insight into that later in the year. In July 76, Prabhupada had come to New York, and on the 11th, he received a letter from Yasamati Nandana Das, who was just setting up a new temple in Ahmedabad in Gujarat in India. So he wrote describing a highly successful Rathiatra in Ahmedabad. The local temples had organized it, and the Mahant of the Jagannath temple there had presided over it. The devotees had a kirtan on the back of a truck during the parade, which the whole city had witnessed. By simply leaning over the truck's side, they sold 1,500 newly printed Gujarati magazines, Bhagavat Darshan, without even getting off the truck. Yasamati Nandan said that he felt that that was a record for our Indian book distribution. However, because they aimed at making sure that everybody got one, they only charged 1 rupee each, and thus they only made 20 paise a profit on each magazine. Yasamati Nandan's description of how they got to participate in the parade was interesting. It was by your direct mercy that we got a place on the truck, because when we met the Mahant of the Jagannath temple, he refused to see us because he thought that we were hippies. Then there was another sadhu standing there, and he knew your divine grace very well. So he said, "You are disciples of Bhaktivedanta Swami?" We said, "Yes." So then he went to the Mahant and introduced us. Then the Mahant said, "Okay, so then they can come on Tuesday and join in on the temple truck with a few sadhus of their own." So that is how we got in. This sadhu's name was Narayan Das, and he is the Mahant of Nilkant Mahadev Rajni Temple in Vadigam. He said that your divine grace had stayed with him for almost 6 months in his ashram 15 or 20 years ago. He was nice, and he said, "Swamiji was a great scholar and was giving lectures in the ashram every day. All day he was writing on the Bhagavatam. He was eating only once, and in the evening just taking milk," which was still the same schedule when I came onto Prabhupada's party in 1976, because he had a little breakfast, but one main meal and then milk in the evening. But this man was saying this is what Prabhupada was doing. All day he was writing on the Bhagavatam. So this must have been, you know, between 1960 to 64 when he visited this ashram and stayed there for 6 months, apparently. Prabhupada didn't give us any further information on that, but that was another recollection. So, again, when we were in New York, July 76, there was several reporters that had come. There was that Kevin Lehart from Newsday. We also had a reporter come from Newsweek magazine. So previously, when Prabhupada had visited America, the local newspapers would sometimes come and do an interview, but we never actually had an interview with one of the really big, you know, magazines like Time or Newsweek. And Rameshwara Swami, he had hired a publicist he had hired a publicist, and this publicist had managed to get Newsweek to agree to send a reporter. Anyway, when the reporter came, it was a junior woman reporter. You know, not like the religions editor or something like that. So when she came, Prabhupada wasn't really interested in seeing her, because he said, as soon as she comes in, she'll just ask, how much money have you got? How many men have you got? How many temples have you got? Like that. So he said, I don't want to see her. But she was already coming up the elevator, so there was not really any choice. So when she came in, immediately that's what she started asking. How big is the movement? How many men have you got? Blah, blah, blah. So Prabhupada refused to talk to her. She asked him some questions, and he said, why? What do you want to know for? This is a Newsweek reporter. So, you know, it kind of went on like this for a few minutes, and then finally the interview started grinding to a halt, because whatever the woman asked, Prabhupada wouldn't cooperate and tell her anything. So to try to save the interview, Rameshwara was there, the publicist was there, and they were kind of thinking, oh no, this is a disaster. So Rameshwara, he intervened at one point, and he said, why don't you ask Prabhupada about his books? That's his, you know, main work. So she did. And then immediately Prabhupada completely changed. So the mention of his books gave Srila Prabhupada the opportunity to guide the interview in the direction that he wanted it to go. So he began to open up a little. He told Wanda that if she really wanted to understand something about him, she should read his books, because a man is known by what he speaks. Tavach chasobite muko yavat kinchinna basate. A fool is so long beautiful as long as he does not speak. When he speaks, then you can understand what he is. So my speaking is there in the books. And if you are intelligent, you can understand. You haven't got to ask. Just like in a court, a big lawyer is known when he speaks. Otherwise, everyone is a good lawyer. But when he speaks in the court, then he is known whether he's a good lawyer or not. So you have to hear and you have to read, and then you will understand. The real understanding is there. So if you want to know Srila Prabhupada, you have to read his books. That's very clear. So as we read there, Prabhupada was, according to that Narayan Das, Srila Prabhupada was working throughout the day with his writing. Once he got into the Bhagavatam, it was very intense. He produced 3 volumes covering the entire first canto within about 4 years and got them published and everything. So that was his whole occupation. When he set up ISKCON, of course, then things had to change, because he could not spend as much time writing anymore, because he had all these new disciples. They were going here and there and opening up new temples. He was flying here and there and, you know, basically traveling around the world like anything. So where was the time for writing? There were a few little spells when Prabhupada kind of withdrew a little bit from traveling. Notably, I think in the late 60s, when he spent a few months in Los Angeles, that was when he completed the Nectar of Devotion, and he did the Krishna book, summary study, and several other works. But apart from that, then it was, you know, difficult for him to get the time. So when I joined his party, Prabhupada had a very established system or routine. And he used to do all of his writing in the night time when everybody was asleep. So on December the 5th, 75, when we were in Vrindavan, it was just after I joined the party, I kind of used that day in my diary to write up a typical day in Prabhupada's life. So I put a composite picture of what Prabhupada's day was like. So I've written there that the evening massage took more than half an hour. Lately, the weather has been cold throughout the night until sunrise. Thus, Prabhupada's circulation and joints need more attention. And then I finally took rest at 11 o'clock. As we disciples slept, Srila Prabhupada rose at 11:30 or midnight to begin his most important work of the day, the translation of the Srimad Bhagavatam and the writing of his transcendental purports. Hare Krishna is a light sleeper, and he often awakens as Srila Prabhupada comes through the servants' room on his way into the darshan room. Rolling over in his sleeping bag, he offers his obeisances as Srila Prabhupada passes by. Sitting at his desk, Prabhupada chanted japa for an hour or so in complete concentration on the holy names. He prayed to Krishna for the ability to serve him nicely and to present the eternal words of the Srimad Bhagavatam in a manner just suitable for the understanding of the entire world, conscious that his work will form the basis for law and order in the next 10,000 years. Putting aside his japamala, he donned his spectacles and clicked on the desk light. He opened the Bhagavatams at the bookmarks. The green Varanasi edition with the Sanskrit commentaries of previous acharyas and the red Bengali one with commentaries by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He leaned forward and studied them intently. The microphone close to his mouth, he flicked on the tape and began his dictation. Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th canto, 7th chapter, verse 25, purport continued. So that's a sample. Prabhupada translating in the night time. That was his schedule. He slept about 3 to 4 hours, not more than that usually. 1 hour after breakfast, 1 hour after lunch, and then usually in the night time, maybe between 10 and 12 o'clock. But very often he would get up, you know, I would give him his massage in the night time, maybe half an hour or 45 minutes, and then I would go to take rest, and Prabhupada would get up immediately afterwards, so maybe only half an hour some nights, and then immediately, and there were one or two nights, as we'll hear, when he didn't even bother going to sleep. He was so, you know, fired up about doing his translation work. And then he would work the whole night long. So that was Prabhupada's regular schedule. So he mentioned this, actually, when he was visited by some professors in Toronto in June 18th of 1976. There was one professor there, Joseph O'Connell. He had seen Prabhupada one time in London, and then he came to see him in Toronto. He was a very friendly person. He likes the devotees. He appreciates Srila Prabhupada and you know, the Hare Krishna movement. I think he has a PhD in Sanskrit or something like that. So they came, and always conscious of his mission and aware of the slightest opportunity for preaching, Prabhupada suggested that professors consider his books to be used as texts in their classes, citing the recent orders that he had received from East Germany. Prabhupada had just got some letter, I think, from Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, who at that time was still Ghanashyam Das Brahmachari. He had gone into East Germany, which at that time, of course, it was all communist. And, you know, in the West, we used to talk about the Iron Curtain. And anything behind the Iron Curtain, that was like very mysterious and dark and something to be feared. You know, we didn't know what was going on in East Germany and Russia and, you know, all these places. We thought, you know, maybe they're going to throw bombs on us or something. So, you know, it was like this mysterious aspect. But Ghanashyam had gone into East Germany, and he had actually succeeded in persuading the professors in the universities there to take Prabhupada's books, you know, order standing orders of them, and that he had sent back reports of his experiences to Srila Prabhupada. So Prabhupada was really, really happy with him that he was doing that work. So he had cited that when he told these professors, why don't you take my books and use them in your classes? So one of the professors asked him how long it had taken to complete the Chaitanya Charitamrita, especially wondering when he found time to write. Prabhupada told him that it took a year and a half to complete the 17 volumes. It sounds, I mean, now a year and a half to do 17 volumes. It's just like impossible, you know. And he explained his schedule. I write in the night. I go to bed at 10:30. I get up at 12:30. Then I finish my chanting, if there is any balance. And then I begin dictating. In the morning, they take it and they type it. So this dictaphone is always with me wherever I go, so that my writing book is not stopped. Maybe a few pages, but something is there daily. Little drops of water wear away the stone. So in that way we have translated so many books. About 54 books are already published, besides the small booklets. And we have published the Bhagavatam 22. I am expecting 60 volumes. 60 volumes of 400 pages. The biggest canto is the 10th canto. I have already published the 10th canto, summarized, Krishna book. But in detail, it will take at least 20 volumes. The 10th is almost as big as the rest of the book, his guest observed. Yes, Prabhupada smiled. There are 90 chapters. And the other cantos, at most 30. But 10th canto, 90 chapters. That is Krishna's face, Krishna's beautiful face. Everyone is attracted by the smiling face of Krishna. So that was, there's a funny story attached to that publication of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, actually. In the earliest edition of Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, I think Penguin had published that. So they had included in the front of that Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita some reviews and appreciations from different scholars. There was Denise Levitov and Thomas Merton, and there was a man called Dimmock, Professor Dimmock, who was considered to be one of the leading authorities, Sanskrit authorities, in the American university system at that time. And he had written like a foreword or a preface to Prabhupada's Gita. So anyway, actually, you know, this man was not really very friendly. He really didn't like the devotees, and he really didn't appreciate Srila Prabhupada. But, you know, he was a big professor, and he had a name. And the devotees thought it would be nice if they could get him to give his endorsement. What had happened was that he wrote one, but it wasn't at all favorable. So, anyway, this man, he was a regular drunkard. You know, half the time he was drunk. So what the devotees did was they wrote up, you know, something themselves, and then they went to see him when he was drunk. And they got him to sign it when he was drunk, and then they printed that in the Bhagavad Gita. So anyway, this Dimmock, his ambition, his life's goal, you know, like his opus for his life's, you know, work, was he was going to translate the Chaitanya Charitamrita into English. You know, this he was working for years and years on this project, and this was going to be the thing that was going to give him his mark, you know, in the scholarly world. He was going to produce the first English translation of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And then in 1975, all of a sudden, 17 volumes, you know, the full Chaitanya Charitamrita is published by the BBT. So the library party had been going around, you know, to all the universities, getting orders, standing orders for the Bhagavatam, and selling full sets of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So they went to see Professor Dimmock. And when they went in and they showed him, Prabhupada's produced, you know, this is the new Chaitanya Charitamrita, 17 volumes with commentary. They said the man practically had a heart attack. He couldn't believe it. That was like his whole life's work gone down the drain because Prabhupada had done it before him in a year and a half. Anyway, so it's a funny story, that one. So, anyway, so as Prabhupada said, then he was writing in the night time. And not ordinary writing either. It's not that he just sat there and automatically, because he knew Sanskrit, then, you know, it would just come out willy-nilly. It was very, very carefully done. As he told us when we were in Hawaii in 1976, in April, Rameshwar had come to see Prabhupada in Vrindavan, and he had told Srila Prabhupada that the BBT had now caught up with his translation work. The year before, when Prabhupada had gone to Los Angeles in 75, the BBT was about 20 volumes of books behind Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada had done them, but they had not printed them. So there was like about 15 volumes of Chaitanya Charitamrita and about, you know, 6 or 7 volumes of the Bhagavatam, just waiting. So Prabhupada was not very happy, and he told them, I'm not encouraged to translate if you're not going to publish them and keep pace with me. So he told them, now I'm here for 2 months. I want all the backlog of books to be printed in these 2 months. 20 volumes. So they were shocked. They were on a morning walk. And Rameshwara said, but Prabhupada, he said, that's like, you know, that's 20 volumes. He said, it's impossible. Prabhupada looked at him, he said, impossible is a word in a fool's dictionary. And they said, no more. So Rameshwara and Radhabalabha, who was the production manager, they immediately left the morning walk. They didn't even wait for the end of the walk. They went straight back to the temple. They called all the BBT devotees together, you know, the editors, the layout people, the artists, whoever was involved. And they said, Prabhupada said we have to produce these books in 2 months, so we're going to do it. So they set a 24-hour schedule, shift work. And they had, you know, like 5 or 6 artists all working on the same painting to get it all done. And, you know, the editors, they were, you know, practically they were hardly eating and sleeping for 2 months. And at the end of it, they actually produced the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita and a couple of volumes of the Bhagavatam in 2 months. So Prabhupada was very pleased. So this was about June, July of 75. So April 76, Rameshwara then came and reported to Prabhupada, we've practically caught you up now. You know, we're just, you know, one volume behind you. So we're hoping now that you'll be encouraged to write more. And so he suggested that on your way to America in this year's summer tour, why don't you stay in Hawaii for 1 month? Because nobody's there. There'll be no visitors. And you'll be freed from any headaches of management. And you'll be able to write more. So Prabhupada said, yes, very good idea. And that's exactly what he did. We went to Hawaii at the beginning of May, and we stayed there for the whole month. And Prabhupada increased his literary output by about 6 or 7 times the amount that he was normally doing. So anyway, this particular day, May the 10th in Hawaii, it was Ekadasi. So before going out for his morning walk, Prabhupada summoned me with a buzzer. Going into his room, I offered my obeisances and knelt before him, eager to execute his bidding. He asked if we had the Sanskrit edition of the Srimad Bhagavatam 8th canto with us. He said that he would finish the 7th canto by the evening. This was very heartening to hear. So I was excited and I expressed my pleasure at this welcome news. Srila Prabhupada remained modest and sober. With a slight smile and an unassuming tip of his head, he told me, "Oh, I can finish it very quickly, but I have to present it for your understanding. It requires deep thought, very carefully, for the common man." So then in the evening, at 9:15 p.m., Srila Prabhupada again called for me. Expecting him to be ready to take his rest and massage, I was surprised to find him already sitting at his desk with his spectacles on and his Bhagavatam open and his dictaphone in his hand. He told me that he would not take his massage. Rather, he said he would finish translating the 7th canto. I was surprised but elated. This is the first time since I've been with him, over 5 months now, that he has missed his evening's rest. He worked all through the night, and afterwards, after he went for his early morning ablutions, I checked the dictaphone and saw that he had notched up 320 digits on the counter. Normally, he only does 50 or less. So, you know, there's a little counter there numbered, and it tells you how much of the tape has been used. So normally, it would be like 30 to 50 digits on a good night. But this particular night, he did 320 digits. It was like 6 or 7 times the amount that he normally did. He was able to get 25 verses of the 8th canto done. He is mercifully fulfilling our hope that by spending extra time here in Hawaii, away from management problems and constant streams of visitors, that he will be able to concentrate on the essence of his preaching work. Everyone is growing very heartened to see how much extra writing he is doing since his arrival here in Honolulu. And if you read the seventh canto, he mentions that today is the Ekadasi day, such and such. We're in Honolulu, Hawaii. And by the mercy of Krishna and Balaram, I've been able to finish the seventh canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So it's nice. You should read that little end note on the seventh canto. So 5 days later, Prabhupada actually, whilst we were in Hawaii, Hayagriva Prabhu came. So Hayagriva, of course, was Prabhupada's original editor when he got started in 26 Second Avenue in 1966 in New York. The first few young men that came to see him, this Hayagriva was one of them, and he was an English professor. So Prabhupada immediately started him on editing his works to get them ready for publication. Then, some years later, Hayagriva had problems. He kind of drifted away. But then in 76, he came back. So the BBT, they asked him to fly to Hawaii and spend 2 weeks with Srila Prabhupada and working on what was then called the philosophy book. So in 1970 or 71, Prabhupada's secretary at that time, Shyama Sundar, who had been a philosophy student before he became a devotee, he had begun to have exchanges with Srila Prabhupada that he was recording, discussing Western philosophy, Greek philosophers and Roman philosophers, whatever. And Prabhupada was very enthusiastic for that project. He would give Vedic commentary on Western philosophy. But somehow or another, then Shyama Sundar, he kind of left and drifted away, and that project was stalled for some time. So in 76, the devotees, they asked Hayagriva, why don't you finish this philosophy book project with Srila Prabhupada? So he came in, and he was spending several hours a day with Srila Prabhupada discussing these different philosophers. So on May the 15th, despite the disruptions of the day, Prabhupada and Hayagriva discussed the philosophies of Socrates and Plato for 2.5 hours this evening. And afterwards, Prabhupada went straight into his translation work, dictating throughout the night and notching up another 315 digits on the dictaphone. So again, you know, 2.5 hours just discussing these heavy philosophy, and then straight into, you know, translating the Bhagavatam all night long without taking rest. So Prabhupada was really, really putting a lot of effort into his book work there. And you can imagine, you know, the kind of concentration that was required. As he said, it requires very deep thought. Every word has to be chosen very carefully. And I got an indication of the kind of concentration that Prabhupada was applying later in the year when we were in Vrindavan on November the 8th in 1976. So just after taking rest at about 11 p.m., I heard the buzzer ring. Rolling out of my sleeping bag, I went into Prabhupada's darshan room, where he was already sitting at his desk, microphone in hand, peering over the pages of the Srimad Bhagavatam. After offering my obeisance, I sat before him, eager to know the purpose of his call. Prabhupada looked at me over his glasses, and indicating something in mid-air, he said, "There's some noise disturbing. Just stop it." I listened, but there was only silence to my ear. Seeing my puzzled expression, Prabhupada's eyebrows raised and his finger pointed upwards. "No, just listen." Again, I listened hard, trying to open my ears and perceive whatever it was that was disturbing his divine grace. After a few seconds, I started to pick up on what seemed to be a very faint, distant hum. Prabhupada was observing me closely, and when he saw the dawn of recognition on my face, he confirmed my perception. "Ha! Now, go and find it and stop it." Now tuned in, I walked off toward the entrance, following the sound which seemed to be coming from a source high up and distant. Going outside, I moved towards the temple, and the sound receded. Going the other way, towards the guest house, the faint vibration began to increase. I entered the building and started up the staircase, the humming beginning to increase in volume the higher that I climbed. Finally, I arrived at the top floor of the four-story building, sure by this time that I had identified the cause. Going down the corridor, I banged on the door of one of the single rooms. After a minute, the door opened to reveal a sleepy, agitated Vishal Das, quite grumpy about being awakened at such a late hour. "Vishal Prabhu," I said humbly, "you've got your fan on, and it's disturbing Srila Prabhupada in his translation work." The fan was hanging from the ceiling, whirling around at full tilt, and I couldn't think why he would want to have it on the cold of a winter night. But there was no discussion. Vishal was immediately profusely apologetic at the thought that he might be causing an inconvenience to Srila Prabhupada, and he quickly shut it off. After thanking him, I went back down to Prabhupada's quarters, and when I entered, he was already deeply absorbed, sitting by the light of his desk lamp, studying the texts and flicking on and off the switch of his dictaphone as he constructed his purports. He gave me but a brief glance of acknowledgement, and I took rest, impressed by the intense concentration that he applies to his work and grateful for the opportunity to assist him in it. So that's a very, very, I couldn't hear it to start with, but Prabhupada was concentrating so intently that a fan four floors up, whirling around, it was bothering him. And actually, there was one other time when Prabhupada actually was unable to work because of some background noise, and that was when we went to Fiji. This was at the end of April 76, and early May. So when we arrived there, Fiji is this small island, and there's not much population. In those days, there wasn't even a TV station. Nobody had TV sets there. This is 1976, so it seemed like very idyllic. And I thought, well, Prabhupada's sure to do some, extra translation work here. And, we set everything up, set up the dictaphone and everything. In the evening, I gave him his massage and then took rest. Then I came in the next morning, and Prabhupada was sitting there chanting japa. And then he told me, he said, "I couldn't translate last night." So I was surprised. I said, "Why not?" So he said the dogs were howling all night long. So all around this small town, Lotoka, where we were staying, there were dogs everywhere. And as soon as it got dark, they began yowling about. And, I don't know whether any of you have been to Vrindavan, but in the nighttime sometimes, if you're up, then there's peacocks. And they tend to kind of be in groups, and they start off in one area of Vrindavan. Like this. And then it spreads. One batch starts, and then the next batch picks up on it, and they start, and then another batch, and it goes all around Vrindavan, like for half an hour sometimes, all the peacocks yowling. So, same thing in Fiji, but there it was dogs. Nothing as auspicious as peacocks. So the dogs, they start in one part, and then they start barking and yowling, and then another batch would start, and then it would go around all night long. So Prabhupada wasn't able to translate. And it happened several nights. He wasn't able to do anything there. So that's the kind of concentration, anyway, that he was putting into it. So it's 9:15. Tomorrow is Janmashtami. We don't want to be late for Mangalarati. What time is Mangalarati tomorrow? 4:30. So we'll finish at this point. Any quick questions before we retire? Yes, Prabhu. How many rounds did Srila Prabhupada chant? That's not on the subject of books. Prabhupada chanted at least 16 rounds. As you heard there, when he spoke with Joseph O'Connell, this professor, he said, "My schedule is that I get up at 12, and then I chant the balance of my, I do the balance of my chanting, and then when that's finished, then I translate." So that's a confirmation, although I never personally asked Srila Prabhupada how many rounds he chanted. But, you know, I saw from his beads, you know, he had the same string, 16, like that, and then the extra four. And as Prabhupada confirmed that, you know, even before he began his translation work, he would make sure that he'd finished all his rounds. So he was doing at least 16. And my observation is that he was doing more than that very often. You know, if there was nothing happening, then he would sit down and he would just chant for a few hours. In Vrindavan, every evening practically in September, October of 76, he used to like going out into the back garden in the evening. He'd give darshan in the afternoon. And then when the aarti started, he would send all the devotees to the aarti. And then he would either sit in his room or he would sit in the back garden and just chant. So he liked to chant japa. So he was doing at least 16, minimum. Maybe more. All right, so I think that we should finish there at this point. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.